Welcome back to DougHammock.com and to our current podcast project on rethinking sex education. I try each episode to post some thoughts to help get a conversation started about a viable and helpful way to educate our young people about sexuality. So, and again, thank you for the many comments and questions that have come in. I often try and integrate those comments into future episodes, and I'm gathering them all to integrate into a book that I'll write at the end of the project. Now, as I mentioned in the update episode, in the first section of this project, we focused on expanding our view of sexuality. We saw how one social institution, the only one that is really hard at work on creating sexual norms around sexual practices, is the institution that is least equipped for the job. We saw how economic forces and economic institutions are reducing the whole human experience of sexuality down to eroticism. We saw the cost that is exacting of us as individuals and us as a society. Also, we looked at an expanded view of sexuality drawing from the wisdom of the ancient Greeks. By broadening how we think about human sexuality, we can see that the sexual journey really is an integrated whole that is bigger than a collection of disconnected parts. And then, informed by that interconnectedness of all the component parts, we're then better able to form a framework for our young people, a more comprehensive understanding of their own sexuality. Now, the objective is to give ourselves and our young a roadmap for the sexual journey, and hopefully to give them insights into the long-term effects that their sexual decisions will have. Now, in this episode, we turn to the second section of the project, the theme of which will be framed by a question that we'll ask ourselves. Does religion have anything to offer sex education? Does religion have anything to offer sex education? Now, as you might imagine, given that I'm a minister, I'll suggest that it does. However, before we can explore what religion has to offer, we need to look at how we've lost our way through the centuries. There's a reason that very few still listen to what religion has to say about sex. So we'll spend a couple of episodes looking at how that happened, because again, forewarned is forearmed. If we can see how we lost our way, we can begin to step back from the errors of the past, and we don't have to take that way again. Now, our religious heritage really does have a gift to offer to sex education. We'll try and recover that ancient wisdom, and we'll try and frame it in a way that our young people can hear. But before we begin this next section, before we try and bring religion and sexual education together in a helpful way, I'd like to begin with a few remarks on how you might use this project. It's possible that this project would benefit young people who would listen. I've invited my adult children to listen along. But young people are not really the target audience for the project. If you've listened to the first section, you've already gathered that this is more helpful for older folks. Older folks have a generational privilege and a generational responsibility to help shape the thinking of our young. Now, we might blanch at the prospect, especially on the topic of sex, but it is a tough truth that we are our kids' best chance for framing a healthy approach to life. And this is especially true for a healthy approach to sexuality. We're the ones who love them, and we're the ones that they are most likely to hear. Now, of course, they will roll their eyes at us, especially if we're mom or dad. It's sometimes easier for grandparents or aunts or uncles or youth ministers, but we are the ones most likely to offer them wisdom in terms they can access. That's what love does. It buys us a platform for speaking to those that we love. Now, communities are their healthiest when they are robustly multi-generational. Older folks offer wisdom and experience and insight to the young. And in turn, younger folks offer energy and creativity and perspective to the old. And one of the more helpful gifts that older folks have to offer to the young is our firsthand knowledge of what the sexual journey is like up the road a bit. And it's my experience that if we frame it well, young people really want to hear what older folks have to say about sex. But there's a bit of a problem at this moment in history, because as a culture, we don't have a shared narrative or any shared norms about how we talk about sexuality. So even though we love our young people, many of us are daunted by the idea of educating them about sexuality. We're even more daunted by religious language about sex education, because religion has often been entrenched and it has become shrill and vapid. So on the one side, religion is tough. On the other side, culture has tended toward a free-for-all. So we have an interior sense as older people wanting to talk to the young that neither one of them is all that helpful. But what we don't have is a sense of what a healthy alternative could be. So in the current environment, it's difficult to argue for sexual restraint without evoking the dismissal that religion has earned. So we grown-ups, we adults wanting to talk to our young people, we either stumble forward with uncertainty, pretty sure that we're getting it wrong, or more commonly, we tend to just avoid the topic. So I put a quick survey monkey out there on the web a while ago to get responses to this question. And I got hundreds of responses back very quickly. The question was simple, but it touched a nerve. What makes talking about sex to young people so tough? What makes talking to about sex with young people so tough? Lots of those who responded cited embarrassment. It's tough to talk about sexuality with our own partners, let alone the young people in our lives. Knowing what is so deep and so important about our sexuality, many in the survey worried that they might get it wrong. Many of us aren't sure we're getting our own sexual lives right. How could we help our young people get it right? Some of us come from families that didn't talk about sex, and we're not sure even we even know how to talk about it. Others grew up in families that did talk about it, but we're all preachy in the process, and we all know how off-putting preachy is. Many people in the survey cited their own hurtful sexual histories, and they're worried about passing their sexual hang-ups onto their kids. We certainly don't want to do that. So, even though we get older, and even though we pick up wisdom along the way, and even though we might have been through the sexual ringer and picked up some wisdom about what not to do, we have misgivings. We have misgivings about passing anything on to our kids for a lot of reasons. And on top of those personal misgivings, there's this whole cultural overlay of what's happening. There's been this big, tumultuous upending of all the conventional sexual norms over these last few generations. It's difficult to know how to talk about sexuality because there is no shared body of conventional wisdom that we can just pass along. Sexual norms are changing in our lifetimes at such a rapid pace that we feel whipsawed. We've only had a few generations to try out these new norms, and we've done a whole lot better at rejecting the old norms that didn't work than we have about figuring out what the new norms might be. So a lot's happened in the last 50 years. 1968 happened. The sexual revolution happened. Contraception happened. Roe v. Wade happened. We no longer fear unwanted pregnancy, and we've experienced this sweeping and rapid change in how we accept LGBT people. The internet has exploded. Pornography has exploded along with it. It's become ubiquitous. Sexuality has changed. It's changed a lot, and it has changed fast. And other social norms have changed as well, norms that affect our sexual lives. People are waiting longer to marry. The upfront educational demands required to be contributors in society take longer than they used to. We used to be ready to contribute to society as soon as we could plow a field or cook a meal. We could do that as early as 16. But now we don't finish college until we're 22, and we aren't established in our careers until our mid-20s, and that's at best. And so we marry later, about a decade later than earlier generations. And we're living longer, which gives us the potential to extend our sexual relationships longer than ever before in history. In 1900, the average length of a marriage was 12 years. In 1990, the average marriage was also 12 years. In 1900, the average was low because people died so young. In 1990, the average was low because more people got divorced. A population that is living longer changes our sexual norms. And today, longevity is highlighting our lack of longevity skills. When it comes to our sexual relationships, we don't know how to create relationships for a lifetime. Now, for a lot of human history, we didn't have to. Somebody just died. So longevity skills weren't all that necessary. So things are changing. Also, the very nature of community is changing. Under pressure from industrialization and urbanization, our networks of human relationships have become smaller and smaller and smaller over the last many generations. We don't live in the kind of extended intimacy that we once did when we lived in tribes or neighborhoods or even extended families. And this social transience has made the units of relationship in which we live smaller and smaller and smaller over the last several successive generations. We don't have the extended web of intimacy that we once did. And consequently, we put more pressure on our sexual relationships to meet those extended intimacy needs, which means that we expect more out of our marriages than previous generations did, because previous generations could access that kind of intimacy in other contexts, in other relationships. But we need more from our marriages, from our sexual relationship, than previous generations did. Also, gender roles have changed. This has been particularly dramatic over the last 60 to 70 years. This seismic shift began during World War II when women entered the workforce and really have never left. Technology has changed the very nature of work. Work doesn't demand the upper body strength that it once did. So as work has changed, how we think about gender roles has changed. We have different ways of thinking about men and women and what is appropriate behavior for them. And this impacts how we approach our sexual relationships. We want different things than we once did. Father doesn't always know best anymore. Dad isn't the boss of the family anymore. There's much more of a focus on equality in our marriages than in previous generations. So we look more for symmetrical sexual relationships, peer sexual relationships, companion sexual relationships. Once, our sexual relationships were as much about the role that we played in society as they were about intimacy. Now that's not the case. Now marriage is a lot less about our place in some hierarchical order and much more about romance or companionship. So, most of these rapid and dramatic social changes have been really good for us, for our society. But boy, do they complicate things. We don't have normalized conventions like we used to. We don't know how to live in this brand new world because it's so new. We aren't adapting as quickly as the changes are washing over us. So again, all of this change whipsaws our thinking about sexuality. How can we adapt the sexual journey in a healthy way while undergoing such rapid change in our environment? So the wisdom that is carried by the older and the wiser among us, while we still have it, while we have indeed gained hard-earned trial-and-error experience, and while we know from that experience what works and what doesn't, we don't always know how to talk about our experience. We don't always know how to stitch together for our young people a narrative of what works and why it does. And even if we do, we can't always articulate it in ways that they can hear. So here we are, carrying deep concerns for our young people, wanting to save them the pain of the mistakes we've made, wanting to help them avoid the traps we have fallen into, but we don't have a framework to guide us. We lack a working narrative of human sexuality. We lack a language to help us advise our young people. And that's what this project is about. It's about hammering out a sexual narrative for ourselves as grown-ups, a narrative that we can internalize, so that we can then translate that narrative in our own words into a language that we can speak confidently to our young people and do it in the context of love, do it in the context of family, do it in the context of community. So it's toward that end, stitching together a narrative that works for us, that I hope to make the case that religion is a good candidate for helping us do that, for helping us work out that story about sexuality. Now, I say that with eyes wide open to the trouble that religion has caused these last several generations. I say it with my eyes wide open to all the evidence that religion's approach to sexual education hasn't worked, and it hasn't worked for some time now. But nevertheless, in this section of the project, we're going to think together about how to frame sexual education while drawing from ancient religious wisdom. drawing from the treasure that is in there that we haven't accessed very well. The point of this section will be to dig into our religious heritage to help us build a sexual framework that works. And to do that, we've got to begin with an honest assessment of what we have done that has not been working. So let's begin there. Let's begin with this point. You and I, we are animals. We have the same limbic system that mammals have. We have the same reptilian and mammalian brains that other animals have. We have autonomic systems that inform our most basic drives. We are born with the drive to eat and to breathe and to thirst and to copulate. Those same drives are in us that are in the other animals, and they are hardwired right in. So any elevated perspective on sexuality, whether it's religious or spiritual or poetic or something else, any elevated perspective on sexuality that doesn't take that basic fact into account will not work very well. We are animals. However, that's exactly what has happened, because religion hasn't been comfortable with that basic premise, and for understandable reason. Religion has always elevated human understanding to a higher plane, and not least with our sexuality. Religion sees human sexuality in loftier terms. Religion has tended to focus on the parts of sexuality that transcend the animals. So while, yes, we do have basic sexual and physical equipment that the animals do, religion focus has been on our other equipment, the equipment that gives us access to the spirituality dimension of our lives. That's been religion's gift. To see that the deepest parts of our humanity and even our sexuality can best be expressed in the language of spirituality. So in religion, we speak about the divine spark, or the interior voice, or the Holy Spirit, or the image of God. We speak of these as deep and real human experiences. And again, as successive generations arrive in history, we find our way back to religious, to spiritual language, because we need it to express this deep part of the human experience. And this language has, through the centuries, given religion a rich insight into our humanity, but also into our human sexuality. It has given us an elevated view, a view that is bigger than the plumbing, bigger than biology. As we saw in the first section of this project, religion sees sexuality as a bigger process than just getting our DNA passed on to the next generation. It is that, but it is more. So sometimes religion has forgotten about our animalness. Our focus has been on the more that we carry inside of us, and it is the more that has been religion's great gift. Our gift has been to see meaning and insight that is embedded in our sexuality that the animals don't see. Again, it's the gift of that moreness that religion brings to the table. So when religion talks about sexuality, the word sacred shows up all the time. That's the moreness that religion sees so clearly. And when we get it right, we don't deny our animal sexuality, because again, we are animals. Instead, we point to a higher perspective. We point to the extra equipment that we carry, extra equipment that gives us access to a bigger picture, that helps us sense in our sexuality something of the divine, something of the sacred. We scramble for words whenever we try and talk about the divine. We try and speak of the rich depths of our sexuality with words like holy or hallowed, divine. So that is what religion offers us, an elevated view of our humanity, an elevated view of our sexuality. But unfortunately, our elevated view has been in such sharp focus that we have often lost sight of our animal nature. In fact, we have tended through the generations to repudiate our animal nature, and this has not served us well. One of the reasons religion has lost its voice around the subject of sexuality, one of the reasons we've lost our moral authority, is just that. We have denied our animalness. Or if we don't, we associate it with something base or something sordid. with our larger perspective on human sexuality, sometimes we've set up an oppositional dynamic. We force ourselves to decide we are either animal or sacred. But somehow we've thought we couldn't be both. Once we've glimpsed the moreness, our tendency has been to suppress our animal parts, or deny them, or ignore them, or renounce them. So again, my starting point is this, that religion has a gift to offer sexual education. But to restore that gift, we have to go back and revisit this misstep. Because it doesn't have to be either or. Sacred does not have to mean not animal. The two are not mutually exclusive. Now, I'm a minister, a Christian minister, and I am deeply rooted in the Christian tradition. My experience there is why I believe religion does have something substantive to offer sex education. But I'm also more aware than most that we Christians have been following a path around teaching sexuality that has dug us into a hole. I am painfully aware that even if we did have something to offer, not many could hear us through the static these days. Not many are paying attention to anything we have to say, really, and the denial of our animal sexual natures, this is part of our problem. We have a gift, but it can't be received by our young people because we have framed our message so badly. Our gift is to see that sexuality is sacred, that it is not casual, it's not unimportant, that sexual intimacy awakens us to divine life. But when we overstate our case and deny or denigrate the parts of our sexuality that are animal, we really lose credibility. Ours is a rich heritage. Ours is a wonderful gift. We know how sexuality thrives. We know about deep and total giving, deep and total trust, deep and total commitment. We bring to sexuality a deep insight into the mechanics of trust. We intuit how to live and love unconditionally. We know that in the wrong context, sexuality pretends to give a gift that it cannot really give. But in the right context, we can only describe the majesty of sexuality with words like sanctity. Religion's deep reverence for sexuality is our great gift, our insight that sexuality helps us become more, not less integrated. This is our great gift. But we don't need to suppress the animal nature of our sexuality to give this gift, to give this elevated vision. Now, in the tumult of today's shifting sexual norms, our wisdom, our gift, is doubly important. Because people are living longer, they really need our insights into creating lasting relationships. Because people live in a more fragmented community, they do need our insight into deep intimacy and broad community. Because people are seeking symmetry and companionship in their sexual relationships, they really do need the gift that religion has to give to help get them there. If religious people are going to offer something of substance to the sex ed discussion, if the culture is going to have access to the ancient wisdom religion has, we have to do better. Because the tumult is on us. The world is changing. Lifespans are extending. Sexual norms are transforming. There is a treasure inside our religious narrative, a powerful story to tell, a powerful gift to give. But to access it, we have to see where we went wrong so that we can get back on track. And that's what we're going to work on in these next few episodes. We're going to look at how things went sideways. We'll think together about unhelpful assumptions and givens that we picked up about sexuality along the way. Before we look at the good, we must look at the not so good. We must think together about what we're going to need to shed as we teach our children about sexuality. So that's where we'll pick up in these next episodes. And as always, I hope you'll join in. I hope you'll comment. In particular, I'd love to hear your stories. What part of religious sex education would you keep? What do you think we should let go? Let me know about that. All right, we'll pick up here next week.